So, Brian, we're going to educate you now. We're going to teach you all about the history of the Cavendish Laboratory. Isn't that right? Isn't that right, Chris?
Hopefully, yes. I'm going to attempt the impossible, Ian, and deal with the history of the Cavendish in a breathtakingly short time.
Yeah. Can you just put that mic? It just needs to point towards you a bit more.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. Then
That's it.
We can hear you loud and clear there.
Brilliant. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you were I was asking you because, of course, the weather has... It's not been a brilliant summer, has it, so far? It's been a bit mixed. But you say that doesn't really affect your guided tours in the city?
No, it's crazy busy at the moment. I think for this weekend, for the first time ever since 2011, since we started, we've actually turned people away.
Wow.
Not something we like to do, but so we just couldn't find guys to do the tours. It's just ridiculously busy.
So how many... You said there are about 10 of you that do them.
Well, we've got a core team of four.
Yes.
And then we use up to about 10 or a dozen or so other guys. We bring them in as necessary.
Yeah.
There's about 130 guides in Cambridge. I mean, they're all very good. They're all qualified green badge guides, all members of the Society of Cambridge Tourist Guides. But you know, we just use about a dozen or so.
And how long does it take to qualify?
It's about a year.
Right.
You have to attend a lecture every week, do lots and lots of reading. Then you have to do the horrible parts, go out on the street with your colleagues, your fellow trainees.
Yes.
And do your spiel in front of them, which is just breathtakingly and agonisingly embarrassing. and just a whole lot of learning and relearning. And it's a bit like passing a driving test in a way. You start driving the car straight away, but actually you really learn to drive once you're out on the road. And you just never stop learning.
I was going to say, you still find out facts and information that you didn't know about the city?
Absolutely. I've been sort of reading about and studying King's College Chapel since 2011. Often, I don't know how many books I've got on King's College Chapel, but it's such a vast building with so much inside it that you could spend a lifetime, really, and not get to the bottom of it.
And presumably, you've got to love it to do it, I guess, haven't you?
Yes, I think it does help if you've got an interest in it. But I mean, it's a tremendous privilege to be able to go into places like King's College Chapel, like Queen's College, and to be allowed in there, which, you know, other people aren't allowed to take groups in. Only green badge guides can take groups inside. And it's a fantastic privilege to know about it and to help sort of bring it to life, really, unlock the secrets.
Well, I always look forward to Tony and you calling by. We had Tony in last time, and we were talking about the Corpus Christi clock, mm-hmm. and indeed the new clock that's appeared in the shopping centre in the Grand Arcade. But this week, we're going to turn our attention to another feature of Cambridge's history: the Cavendish Laboratory, where so many amazing discoveries have been made and people have won Nobel Prizes and goodness knows what. So when did the Cavendish get going?
Well, I think, as you mentioned earlier on, full marks in 1874, actually.
I did a bit of research.
Obviously been doing your homework, yeah. Yeah, no, it is an extraordinary. There are very few sites in the world like the Cavendish. To quote the Professor of History of Science at Cambridge University, Simon Schaffer, who's is a friend and an absolutely brilliant lecturer and speaker, if any ever get a chance to hear him, go along. He says it's where modern physics was invented.
Really?
Quite simply, where the secrets of the universe were unlocked. 29 Nobel Prizes have been awarded to people who worked inside the Cavendish, and there are very few sites around the world where so much significance happened on one single site. And it's really where Cambridge changed. Cambridge is today a high technology powerhouse, one of the biggest technology clusters in Europe, if not the biggest, generating £35 billion worth of revenue a year, employing hundreds of thousands of people. And it all really started with the Cavendish.
Did it? And how did the Cavendish come into being then? What sowed that seed?
Well, it's trying to sort of cut a very long story short-ish. In the middle of the 19th century, science wasn't even taught at Cambridge. Maths was the thing. Young men came here, no women, of course, at that stage.
Uh-huh.
That's another unhappy story. We can come on to that. But there was a realisation in the outside world. We were a major industrial power at that point, vying with Germany. The United States was still sort of a new kid on the block. And there was a realisation by visionary people that perhaps we needed a research laboratory or two. And so Oxford got on and built the Clarendon Lab, and Cambridge formed a committee to think about it. But eventually the logjam was broken by the Chancellor of the University, William Cavendish, 7th Duke of Devonshire, who gave £6,300 to build the Cavendish Lab on the understanding that the colleges would get together and put up the money for a professor.
Right.
The first professor of experimental physics in Cambridge was a man called James Clerk Maxwell. Have you heard of James Clerk Maxwell?
I have heard the name, but I don't know much about him.
Yeah, no, well, he's in the world of science, he's absolutely major.
Right.
At the time of the last millennium, there was an opinion poll amongst scientists, so the most influential physicists of all time. And, of course, in first place was Isaac Newton.
Yes.
Who spent all his academic life at Cambridge at Trinity College from the
60s. I have heard of him.
You've heard of the apple falling from the tree?
Indeed.
Second place was Albert Einstein, who somehow struggled along through life without having come to Cambridge. And in third place was James Clerk Maxwell.
And what did Maxwell do that made him so become so famous?
Very, very complicated stuff. It's electromagnetics. He's seen to be responsible for the second great unification of the principles of physics, the first having been done by Isaac Newton.
Right.
He died quite young, and the Maxwell equations in his work are not really readily accessible to minds like mine. And so there should be... He's very Scottish. He took the first colour photograph, which is a tartan ribbon.
Oh, right.
Very religious. And there should really be statues to James Clerk Maxwell all over Scotland, but I rather fear he's kind of fallen off the map a little bit, but he shouldn't have.
And did he lecture here as well as research?
Absolutely. He was apparently an appalling lecturer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but his main role really was to get the whole thing going. So I mean, if you walk down Free School Lane, which is a terribly rich historical site, there's lots going on in Free School Lane. We could probably do a separate section on that. You come to the Cavendish Laboratory and you'll see what to all intents and purposes looks like a kind of neo-Gothic or an old medieval type building with its pointed arches, cobbled gateway, big oak doors with inscriptions in Latin from the 4th century version of the Bible. Maxwell was very religious. That is largely a smokescreen. It was designed by Maxwell to look old, to look traditional.
Yes.
It's right next to a 14th century wall of a Corpus Christi college. And the reason being, he didn't want to alert the outside world to the professors of other colleges that something quite radical was going to take place inside the Cavendish. And at the same time, he didn't want to worry the parents of the young boys that were coming here, because for the first time, they were going to be doing real experimentation. And there was a class thing. In those days, if you were a certain class, what you didn't do was work with your hands.
Right.
And he knew that for the first time, these young men were going to be rolling their sleeves up, literally, and doing some hard experimentation. Albeit at the start, they weren't particularly good at it, but they learned.
And as we come into more modern history, they were involved with the atom as well at the Cavendish, I think.
Yeah, extraordinary. I mean, it began with in 1897, J.J. Thompson, James Joseph Thompson, the first great professor of physics, discovered the electron. And if you imagine everything that flowed from that into particle physics. The golden year probably was under Ernest Rutherford, the New Zealander, who is considered to be the father of nuclear physics. In 1932, Cockcroft and Walton split the atom for the first time in a controlled way inside the Cavendish. There's a much longer title for it than that, but if you and I know it's splitting the atom.
Yes.
and James Chadwick discovered the neutron in 1932. Rutherford had already theorised about it and discovered the proton in 1919, but it was really the discovery of that neutron that led on to atomic energy and perhaps more unfortunately, the atomic bomb.
Yes, indeed. And as well as all of that, there's a very close connection between medicine and the work that goes on there, as biology and that kind of thing.
Well, in 1953, James Watson, the American scientist, and Francis Crick, the British scientist, determined the structure of DNA.
Right.
Deoxyribonucleic acid, in case you're about to ask.
Very good. I'm impressed. Full marks for that one.
Probably the most important biological discovery of the 20th century. But that was biology or microbiology, but it was done inside a physics lab using X-ray crystallography, which was also developed by a director of the Cavendish, William Lawrence Bragg, and his father, Henry Lawrence Bragg. They both got Nobel Prizes in 1915. And in fact, Lawrence Bragg was the first Australian to win a Nobel Prize.
And in terms of studying there, is it very? Do they take the creme de la creme? Is it very hard to get in?
I think what they did back in the early days, I'm sure it's still the same. I mean, if you're good enough, they want you.
Yeah, sure.
You know, up until the 1890s, you couldn't work in Cambridge, you couldn't research in Cambridge unless you had a Cambridge degree. But that was changed in 1895. When outsiders were allowed to come in, indeed encouraged to come in, and the first arrivals were Ernest Rutherford from New Zealand and a Scot, Charles Wilson, who got the Nobel Prize for inventing the cloud chamber, a clever little gadget in which you could actually form clouds.
Wow.
But that was used by J.J. Thompson in his experimentation because of a kind of a byproduct of that. Yes, they could form the clouds, but J.J. was able to spot, he could actually see droplets forming on something that he knew must be there, which turned out to be the electron.
Incredible. I mean, it is an incredible history, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they have now spread, because the Cavendish is not just in that one location, is it?
No, they moved out in 1974. Today, the building is a collection. There's a marvellous lecture theatre there, which sadly is unused, the Maxwell Lecture Theatre. I've been inside there along with Tony. A lot of empty rooms, examination halls, and some rooms that are sealed off, because in the early days, they didn't know about the dangers of radioactivity.
Wow. So they remain sealed?
They remain sealed. So the site is being regenerated and refurbished inside. It's a big site. I mean, in terms of the whole history of Cambridge, that site, the new museum site, dates back to the 14th century.
Yes.
It's exactly the same site. It was an Augustinian monastery.
Was it?
And then it became, when Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries, then it became the university's physic garden. Yes. Every early modern institution of learning had its own garden for its plants and herbs, for medicine and for research. And then the Botanic Garden. Then the Botanic Garden was moved to where it is today by John Stevens Henslow, Darwin's mentor. Darwin was, of course, at Cambridge from 1827 to 1831. And then the university got going in its first big building programme for the sciences, which was actually museums, not labs. In the early 19th century, the institutions of learning were museums. So if you were studying engineering, for example, you went to the museum.
I didn't know that.
If you were studying engineering,
that's interesting.
You went to the Museum of Mechanism. And there would be tables and shelves with model cranes, model gears, model pile drivers, model steam engines, and that's how you learn engineering.
Fascinating.
Through museums.
Wow.
But so that all, 1974, they closed their doors and they moved to the West Cambridge site.
Yes.
And now, as I'm sure as you know, the Northwest Cambridge site, huge investment by the university, is being built as we speak. And there will be yet another, the third incarnation of the Cavendish will appear out there.
And do we know when that's going to materialise?
No, I mean, the building is underway, so I would imagine within a year or two.
Wow, that will be something to be seen. And if people want to go and take a look at the original site, it's close to the Market Square, isn't it?
You go along Bennett Street, and then you pass down a little sort of pedestrianised area, and on your right-hand side will be the oldest church in the entire county of Cambridgeshire, St Bennet's.
Yes.
Dates back to 1030.
Yes.
And then you'll be into Free School Lane. And very quickly, on your right-hand side, you'll see the 14th century clunch wall of the back of Corpus Christi College, the oldest court in Cambridge. And then your left-hand side will be the Cavendish, complete with its OG arches, pointed arches over the windows, cobbled gateway. And if you look up, you'll notice some striking features about the building. It's big. It's three floors, each carrying a huge workstation plus a basement. But the windows are particularly big because James Clerk Maxwell knew that they were going to need a lot of good steady light. And of course, this was the days pre-electricity.
Yes.
But under each window is a platform, which you might imagine is for a plant box.
Yes.
But they weren't. The platforms were for helioscopes, clock-driven mirrors that would rotate around as the sun passed across the sky to reflect the maximum amount of sunlight into the room, even on the rare occasions when the sun does shine in Cambridge.
Wow. Well, listen, it's a fascinating topic. And Free School Lane, I like the sound of that. A trip down there maybe next time
we can maybe do a trip together. There's a lot to talk about down Free School Lane. But as I say, this is the whole theme of this was sort of hidden gems and things hidden in plain view. Was we did St Edward King and Martyr Church before.
Indeed.
Which is passed by thousands of people every day, and they don't know the significance of it. The Cavendish is in a bit more of a backwater, Free School Lane. It's not a popular thoroughfare. Most people go along Trumpington Street and King's Parade. So
yeah.
The only people that tend to go down, they're mostly are tour groups. But if anybody's listening, pop down there and have a look at it.
Yeah, there you go, to go and take a look at Free School Lane. OK, well, listen, Chris, thank you very much for coming in as ever. Fascinating visit. And I think we've got Tony back in a month, and I'll see you in a couple of months' time.
Lovely, thank you very much, Ian.